Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is Wednesday, April 29th, 2020. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Abe, you are looking, as we are on Skype and can look at each other, and you and I finally saw each other yesterday after 6 weeks in person. You are looking like Grizzly Adams.
That's the goal.
You are looking like, and I'm not quite sure. And then in about another 6 weeks, you will look like somebody in ZZ Top.
Grizzly Abe.
Grizzly Abe. Okay. Or I don't know. Right. Senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine. Who does not look like Grizzly Adams, I'm happy to say. Associate editor Noah Rothman, sporting the Latin lover beard, I would say.
Hi, John. Correct? That works. Yeah.
Okay. And looking startlingly no different from the way he often looks, our guest today, commentary contributor, Bloomberg opinion columnist, and all-around humorist, Eli Lake.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Before we get started, I just want to say a very quick thing for that neoconservative American community, I guess. This podcast, your website, and the latest issue in particular, but the magazine, has been a lifeline in a crisis that often makes me crazy when I read like Paul Krugman or I'm listening to NPR or watching, you know, what used to be the Chavez level daily press briefings from Trump. And so I just want to thank you for doing it 5 days a week, because it has been a really great thing for me, and I would imagine many others.
Well, that's thank you.
No, thank you, Eli.
That is very kind. And I should say that we've been doing some digging into the data. And this week, compared to this week last year, the podcast audience over the course of the week has tripled. So we're very flattered and grateful. Not this week versus last week. This month versus the last 28 days of this year versus the last 28 days of last year, in the same time period, a tripling of our audience. So, so that is very heartening, and we thank everybody, Eli, and everybody else who has found us to be a lifeline. I want to just start by saying this, which is that I find myself in disagreement with everybody at all times. It's like being a hypercritical parent or something, where, you know, nothing that anyone does is acceptable. From, you know, if they work too hard, then they're not playing enough. If they play enough, then they're not working hard enough. All of this. So it's like, in any given moment, my mood shifts. When I read something that says this is all overblown, I go, it's not overblown. And then when I read something that says we all need to stay home and do this for another year, I'm like, you don't know what you're talking about. And I can't, doesn't seem to be any middle ground that I find comfortable. Like yesterday, a thoughtful reader sent me one of these emails that said, look, it's like the flu. Here are the numbers. They're very flu-like and all that. And, you know, so you look at the flu seasons, and so there were, you know, in the worst flu season, what was it, 3 years ago, there were 60 to 80,000 deaths from the flu in the United States, a terrible, terrible year. Usually it's more like 25 to 30. But, of course, that's spread out over 5 months. We've had what appears to be about 60,000 in 6 weeks. I don't know how on earth you can look at these two numbers and say that they are remotely equivalent. We don't, you know, we haven't, this isn't over. We don't know how long it's going to last. Flu seasons are typically 20 weeks in length. We've only been six. So, and yet on the other hand, when I read people saying, you know, this is terrible. Here's a photograph of three people who are standing 5.2 feet apart as opposed to 6 feet apart. They should all be killed. I want to throw something at the screen. Does anybody? I mean,
But isn't this remarkably similar to the dynamic before the pandemic, which is to say, this is kind of how you end up at the never, never Trump position, right? Or the anti position.
Yeah, there's a flavor of self-worth that's tied up in the experimentation on the state level. Like if you are devoting all your energy to castigating Brian Kemp in Georgia while ignoring Jared Polis, you're just a hack.
Jared Polis in Colorado because he's a Democrat and Kemp is a Republican.
The worst for me is the Rorschach test that has become of all the data coming out of Sweden. That you cannot get a straight answer from the press about what we're seeing from Sweden. The New York Times published a piece yesterday. It was pretty balanced, really wasn't that terrible. And it presented a nuanced picture, but one that was more positive than negative. And there were two sentences that almost abutted. They were separated by one sentence. Sweden will have to face its broad failing with people over the age of 70, and went on to the statistics about the deaths of people over the age of 70. The following sentence, that percentage is roughly on par with most other countries. How do you launch into a diatribe about how terrible this data is while excusing it in the very next sentence? It's as though there's some sort of, you have to genuflect to the, at least the moral, I guess, obligation that you have to attack Sweden for having a lax lockdown policy, even though we're all privy to the same data and the data suggests that it's complicated and you can't really draw a firm conclusion one way or the other. But there is one preferred narrative in the press that is to the exclusion of all others, which is that anything that is anything less than a total lockdown, total economic shutdown to the extent that it's possible, sans emergency and essential personnel, is a moral failure. It's as though they're trying to stop people from questioning the values that we're trying to, the competing values here between life and liberty.
Well, and the Sweden experiment in particular, we actually won't know until the fall and into the winter, because the whole logic, from what I understand, of their experiment is that they build up a little bit better herd immunity among their population so that when the virus returns, as most of the experts say it will, they'll be in better shape. So that spike that a lot of the rest of us will experience a little bit more viciously, it will not be as dramatic there. So even judging their experiment now is premature, at least.
According to the Times report and according to the Swedish officials that they quoted, their serological tests suggest that the percentage of the population that has got it is roughly the same as New York City.
Exactly.
Right. Which is bizarre, by the way, which is a bizarre thing, because in that same story, this health commissioner in Sweden, and who knows whether this is a good, you know, a skilled official, a bad official, we don't know anything about him, we don't know anything about Sweden's health stats and all of that, says that they're weeks away from basically having national herd immunity. Really? With 25%, only 25% in Stockholm having that somehow is going to mystically translate to 100%, you know, like 60%. Okay. In a couple of weeks. I mean, maybe I'm not an epidemiologist, as I say every day. That just seems like an absurdly optimistic projection. And so, you know, but we don't know, since nobody knows why the disease attacks, whom it attacks, and what its etiology is and what it does inside the body, the notion that it maybe there are conditions in, you know, among the Nordic populations that make them less susceptible to falling, you know, to getting savagely ill from the disease, or that it's easier for them to contract herd immunity or something like that. I don't know. But the one interesting thing is that the official in question was being handled with kid gloves, as he is everywhere, for making these statements that I'm not sure if you were making them on the stage with Trump, everybody would be like having a total cow. But so you have the Sweden thing. I have this sort of everybody is wrong and everybody is right and everybody is wrong. This notion of comparing the flu to the virus, when we don't know how many people are going to die from the flu that isn't the virus this season, right? I mean, the virus isn't the flu. It's a different disease. Therefore, there will be deaths from flu that have to be accounted for. And then it turns out, if you read the stuff on the CDC's own site, the deaths from flu are not emergency room. You know, a lot of this is survey data or extrapolations based on death tolls and the fact that people are dying at a certain age without other things having killed them, and then they assign that to the flu. Whereas, you know, so we don't
compare deaths at the same time last year, and then make a rough assessment.
You know, John, I think part of the issue here is that both sides of the argument have their wishful fantasies. If you are scared to open back up, you convince yourself that we are going to lick this thing if we just stay locked down a little longer. We're almost there. We've come this far. The numbers are falling. Let's stick with it. And I don't think that's actually realistic. I mean, we're not going to knock it out. At some point after that, we're going to come back out, and there's going to be some sort of spike. If you are eager to reopen, I think you go with this sort of idea that the virus is far less fatal than we had previously thought. Therefore, it's okay to reopen. Now, I sympathize with the latter side more than the former at this point. But you don't need to sort of downplay the gruesomeness of the virus to get there. I mean, I think this has to do with sort of not wanting to face the genuinely tough decision of
I'm going to get Eli in here real quick, but this is what drives me absolutely insane. Yesterday there was an AP report that was passed around from mainstream journalists, big name mainstream journalists, just wrenching over the discovery that we had at 52 infections associated with the April 7th elections in Wisconsin. 450,000 people voted in those elections. There were thousands of workers at every poll. Most of the poll workers were more susceptible than the voters. That's, I don't know what consists of a spike, but 52 out of 450,000 doesn't seem like it to me. It seems to me like evidence that individuals can be trusted to mitigate as much danger around them as possible and navigate this environment safely.
Okay, so here's the data that I think have an interesting Rorschach test effect, okay? According to the CDC's death statistics, right? This is from the New York Times. Total deaths in seven states that have been hit hard by the virus are nearly 50% higher than normal for the 5 weeks from March 8th through April 11th. Remember, that's 8th through the April 11th. That's 2.5 weeks, right? That doesn't even take in what's happened between April 11th and April 29th. 9,000 more deaths than were reported as of April 11th in official counts of deaths. So that would indicate that this question of how many more people have died because of the virus who hasn't been explicitly assigned to the virus is like a total nationally of 9,000. Okay, so we have this huge spike. Deaths are three times in New York City what they were this time last year, or something like that. 172% in New Jersey, 120% in Massachusetts. Okay, so what does this tell us? Well, so then you're looking at this and you're saying, well, okay, so it's worse than the flu. But how much worse is it really than the flu? And this is where I think there is an interesting problem with the way this conversation has been conducted nationally, which is, since we don't have any way of saying it is worth the economy shrinking by, as it is now, in the last quarter, 5%, and next quarter will be 20%. It is worth shrinking, you know, that to that extreme degree in order to prevent a much worse death toll in the United States. Are we then saying that doing this to the extent that we've done it wasn't worth it because not enough people have died to justify it? I mean, I think that's actually what the skeptics are saying. But of course, they won't say it that way because it sounds horrible, and they're right not to want to say it that way. And it is unfair because we make as people keep saying bloodlessly, we make these calculations all the time. So I don't know. That's my Eli. What are your pandemic?
Well, first of all, you're totally right about this feeling of the ping-ponging dissent. And I think that's what's captured in this podcast and in commentary so well, and why I consider myself part of that community, because I think that was a condition before the pandemic, and it's only been exacerbated. So what I found recently is that, you know, I think you guys were sort of baffled by the fawning coverage of Governor Cuomo. And there's this really good scandal. I mean, it's not good, but it's a good story about his initial order to send COVID positive patients to nursing homes and how that probably exacerbated the spread. It was a really bad decision. And then you compare and contrast that with, you know, everything the president did, even the things that were good, is the end of the world. And then the president does something that in the grand scheme of all of this is not the worst decision he's made, but it infuriated me, which is he insisted on, like Nucky Thompson, signing his name to the check that allocated our money to people in this an economic crisis. So you do have this kind of feeling of like, on the one hand, I think, and you said it a couple days ago, Noah, where you said the press really isn't doing Andrew Cuomo any favors by not covering him critically, because, you know, in a function, when our republic is functioning right, the press kind of is this corrective. And Cuomo is thinking that he's a genius and he's going to be the next, you know, vice president or president or whatever. And he has made a lot of decisions that were terrible, and he should be paying a kind of political cost for this. And that gets into a lot of other issues. But on the other hand, it's like, I just find that the combination of that one move, I'm going to sign the checks and give everybody a letter telling them this is from your president, Donald Trump, is such an egotistical, massive waste of time in the middle of a crisis. It's in line with like him talking about the 2016 election, you know, in these interminable press conferences, and you know he's not going to change. And just saying anyone is a better than this in this moment, even though it's not the worst thing in the world, and I'm not blaming him, and I'm not like doing this game where blood is on his hands and all this other crap, which I also hate, but that idea that it's still all about him when we need a leader to kind of try to maybe bring us together is infuriating.
Okay, so let's talk about something that is even more infuriating. More infuriating isn't even the word for it. So last night in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, there was a funeral, and Satmar Hasidim gathered for the funeral and did not practice proper social distancing. Mayor Bill de Blasio announced first on Twitter that he was going there personally to deal with this, and then let loose the following tweet an hour later. My message to the Jewish community and all communities is this simple. The time for warnings has passed. I've instructed the NYPD to proceed immediately to summons or even arrest those who gather in large groups. This is about stopping this disease and saving lives, period. Now, aside from the fact that the Satmar revealed almost immediately after this tweet that the shutting down of the streets to make the funeral work the way they wanted it to work was done by the NYPD. They set up, you know, pylons on the street to close the streets off, and therefore it was an official policy of the city of New York government to allow this funeral to proceed. I just want to read the phrase again. My message to the Jewish community, comma, and all communities, comma, is this simple. The time for warnings has passed. His message to the Jewish community. Now, I've thought that Bill de Blasio was alternately and seriatim, an idiot, a commie, a Sandinista lover, a pothead, a a person who is the first mayor of New York City who doesn't really like New York City that much, incompetent, allowing sort of like homelessness to take root and degrade the city, allowing the subway system to degrade because of no enforcement of vagrancy rules inside on subway platforms, and a crook because he did $100 million in went missing on a nursing home project on the Lower East Side that went into the pockets of developers, and that only through a mysterious court ruling was de Blasio not indicted himself personally for this act of graft. So these are all the things that I have thought of Bill de Blasio, including, and ridiculous, a comic, ludicrous figure in his presidential campaign. Being an evil, barbaric anti-Semite was not actually on that list, but it has now gone to the top of that list. His message to the Jewish community, because there was one funeral in one neighborhood where people went to a funeral, even if they shouldn't have done it or done it in the way that they did it, they went to a funeral. They weren't like having an orgy. They went to a funeral wearing masks, by the way, if you see the pictures. How many Jews do you think there are in New York City? Anyone want to guess the number?
1.5 million.
That's right. 13% of the city's population. So there were a couple hundred people at a funeral. 1.2 million, I think, is the actual number. A couple hundred people go to a funeral, and the warning is to the Jewish community, which once, by the way, did make up 30% of the city's population. So even a lousy commie anti-Semite politician like Warren Wilhelm Jr. Would have been too chicken to say such a thing about a population of 31% of the city. But now, okay, so it's 13%. And it's fine because he's also not going to run for office again. So if he were to drop dead today, right now, you wouldn't see any tears rolling down my cheeks.
Well, can I just say that the broader context here is really also very important, which is that the spike in anti-Semitic crime and anti-Semitic, basically hate. Anti-Semitic crime has increased dramatically on his watch. He has had little to say about it and nothing to do about it. And so I think when you see, so the tweet also has to be understood in that context, because he's happy to call out an extremely small group of people who were practicing who were trying to honor their dead, and turn that into a blanket generalization about a large community, large and very diverse community, when that same community is targeted by perpetrators who it would be politically incorrect to call out for their own membership in a community, he's happy to stay silent. So I do, that was what filled me with blind rage when I saw the tweet.
And that gives away the game, right? I mean, he comes from a political ideology and a particular outlook that is extremely sensitive to speech, the implications of speech, the implications of political posturing. And it doesn't have to manifest in negative outcomes immediately. You can foresee negative outcomes. This is just the bedrock understanding of the social justice left. And it is entirely absent when he says, hey, all you Jews, and everybody else, but mostly you Jews, knock off. It suggests that deep down, there is an antipathy towards this community, that they do not deserve the kind of forbearance that would be accrued to any other ethnicity or religious denomination.
If I can add like one more, and I'm Leal Leibowitz for Tablet wrote a very good scathing column about this. But, who has done more to endanger New Yorkers? The Satmar Jews attending the funeral that he's talking about, or Mayor de Blasio himself, who was very slow to pick up on the danger that the coronavirus posed to New York City, and was in as of early March, encouraging New Yorkers to continue to do things that they normally did, including going to movie theaters and so forth. So I just wonder if some of this is just a bit of blame shifting on his part, and a pretty pathetic example of that.
Yeah, to Noah's point, there have been violations of social distancing
all over this town in all sorts of communities. They're pretty well publicized. They're so-called bottle clubs, which are sort of, like a sort of kind of makeshift nightclub hangout situation, all around the five boroughs. He has not signaled out any community before this.
Okay, so
he's in the parks.
The playgrounds of New York City were closed a month ago. Why were they closed? Because teenagers, not kids in playground, teenagers were congregating in large numbers in playgrounds, particularly in the Bronx and in parts of Brooklyn, right? So we can infer from the locations of these gatherings that the groups of kids who were hanging out were probably Hispanic in nature, okay? In nature. They were Hispanic, of Hispanic origin. I don't recall de Blasio or Governor Cuomo, who is the one who ordered the shutdown of the park, saying, I have a message for the Latino community. This has to end. I am informing, and everybody else, but the Latino community. You know why they don't say that? Because they would never say such a thing. They would never say such a thing about the African-American community, nor should they. They should not. It should not be said. It's not about what people's ethnic derivations are. And what's more, again, this was not kids hanging out in a playground. To be fair, context matters. There is no question that there has been a problem with spread because of the extremely communitarian nature of Hasidic Jewry in New York City and in Israel, who their lives are lived congregationally. Everything they do is group. This is incredibly difficult for them and on them. There is no life outside of communal life in the Satmar community or in the Hasidic community or anything like that to a degree that is very hard for secular people to understand. So enforcing these rules has been difficult for precisely this reason. And rules were people were attempting to follow the rules at this funeral. There was not a person out in the street in these photographs who did not have a mask on. The question is, once you arrive and there is nowhere to stand, what do you do then? And if the cops were out because they had set the pylons up, why didn't the cops say, I'm sorry, there are too many people, you can't come in, right? Because, I don't know, people do that all the goddamn time. They do it in Times Square on New Year's Eve when things get too crowded. They don't let you go somewhere when the streets are getting too crowded. They didn't do it. There was an agreement between the Satmar and the cops last night. Efforts were being made to fulfill this problem, and then de Blasio went hog wild. He is not able to run for office again in 2021. I hope that he goes and disappears from public life. I hope that he spends the next 18 months in disgrace. By the way, he hasn't deleted the tweet. He hasn't deleted the tweet. He hasn't apologized for the tweet. There is nothing that he has done except maybe sit in his room and smoke his bong until his eyes come out of his head.
And you know he's getting an MSNBC show probably after. Like, I mean, it's just a matter of time.
You're probably right.
I so don't think that's true.
Okay.
The degree to which people in this city, I know that he won these large, these ridiculously large landslide elections in which the first election, 24% of New Yorkers participated, and the second, 17% participated. So just to give you a sense of how much the city, really went out, all out, to elect Bill de Blasio. People hate him here. And what's more, the liberal elite hates him.
He also has the personality of a bath sponge. He just is not an interesting guy. I mean, as much as we have disagreements with Christine Quinn, for example, she's got a personality. She's interesting. I don't know if Bill de Blasio can carry a quarter hour.
I think he's interesting as an object of contemplation, as a kind of paradigmatic figure of the left.
you know, I mean, there is this, you know, there, you know, not to just character assassinate, but since he, you know, but since basically he went Gauleiter Julius Stryker on us, I don't really matter. But, you know, a guy who, you know, a guy who picks coffee beans in Nicaragua and then marries a lesbian, you know, and then basically wins election as an Italian who is actually half Italian and changes his name from his father's name, and then, you know, basically uses his 15-year-old half African American son as a blocking tackle to get himself the mayoralty, is a very interesting figure, I would say. It's an interesting political type of us at a certain moment in time that one hopes we will not see repeated. That is that, and what's more, in a world in which racial and ethnic authenticity is so deeply important to everybody, the fact that, you know, he changed his name, you know, he does not have the name that he was born with. He changed his name in his 20s. Apparently he did so because he was so gravely upset at his father's suicide. But then, of course, is happy to use his father's suicide as a political tool whenever he thinks it's helpful to him. He's a contemptible figure, and he has done no good as mayor. I mean, it's now, you know, almost 7 years as mayor, and everything that has redounded to his benefit are things that were set in motion and continued in motion long after he did not do what he probably wanted to do and screw up the policing in the city, because that he knew, if there were actual numbers, stats that would show that crime rose on his watch, as they have, by the way, in the last year. But, you know, again, he's not running for re-election. But if that had actually happened, there really would have been a kind of revolt against him. As it is, there will be a revolt against this form of mayoralty. I don't know who's going to be mayor next. I don't know how that race is going to be run next year. That's when the new mayor will be elected. But whoever it is going to be an anti-de Blasio figure. Somebody who will promise to clean up the subways. Somebody who will promise to be maintain excellence in the schools, for example, or to ensure that the streetscape of the city is not overrun by indigent opioid addicts lying on the sidewalk.
I'm of a mind that everybody should be punished electorally across the board. Anybody in office at this point deserves to be just ejected and live in ignominy just because of the nature of these circumstances. But I don't think that I'm one of many people who think that. I mean, the polling suggests that everybody is quite content with whatever the extent to which your governor or mayor or municipal figure has performed here has performed relatively admirably. I mean, with the exception of the president, who seems to have lost whatever bounce he had in the early days of this epidemic, there does seem to still be a rally around the flag effect for just about everybody else. So I know I'm in the minority, but I do hope that everybody goes really irrational with this thing and just, you know, punishes everyone, because I'm of that mind.
Well, the virus is going to cover a lot of sins for the savvy politician, right? Everything that they were doing wrong that has come to fruition during the pandemic will be blamed on the pandemic, which of course they only had so much control over. And I think it will serve as cover for a lot of people and de Blasio among them.
I don't think so. I think there's a famous book by Eric Hoffer called The True Believer, which tries to outline what are the personality types that join revolutions. And we are ripe for one right now, because it's not people who have been had generations of poverty and, you know, are sick of things. It's people who've lost something in a very short amount of time. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at, you know, I don't know, 20% contraction in the economy, then I think you're going to see a wave I think we're going to see something. Hopefully we won't have a real revolution. We have an escape valve in our republic, and we'll have an election where lots of new people will be elected. But I think that that's coming.
I think that the longer, the deeper the pain gets,
it will be very bad for the political class, whether or not they can say that there was nothing they could do and it's not fair. And indeed, that will be the line of the president of the United States if he loses re-election, and how he will run for re-election and how he will start running to become president again in 2024, which I think is a lead pipe cinch that, you know, Trump loses and he starts running again, because then he can have rallies and, you know, be revivified in that fashion. All are punished, as the Duke says at the end of Romeo and Juliet. You know, the just and the unjust alike. In a moment like this, there is a kind of everything went wrong here, right? And the political system can't change the people who run the banks, right? This is why everybody was so enraged and livid after the financial meltdown. That, you know, the only thing you could do is throw them in jail. But, you know, the politicians can't make people at banks be forced out of banks, or, you know, mortgage companies or whatever. You know, that's not what – but people can throw politicians out. That's what happened in 2010, right? 63 Republicans won House seats against – and 6 Republicans won Senate seats. That was all anti-Obama, but it was also the throw the bums out moment from 2008, just as Trump, I think, was the throw the bums out of the White House moment from 2008, downshifted to 2016, because there was no reckoning for that, oddly enough, in 2012. So that's where I go.
Do you think we'll see a return to the kind of crime wave that we saw in big cities in the 60s and 70s and 80s?
No, well, I mean, I think there's a demographic problem there, because remember, the crime wave was also a species of the baby boom, in a perverse species of the baby boom.
Sure.
You know, there was just a much larger population and a lot of people to commit crimes. And now, you know, part of the thing about the decarceration movement is people are going to get out of jail, but they're 45, 50 years old, and they're just not going to be as efficient in going back to lives of crime. And there aren't that many kids, you know, there just aren't that many dangerous.
Also, cities were much more corrupt and police were more corrupt. I mean, there was a lot of things added to it, but listen, if we're going to see lots of people who were kind of comfortably middle class suddenly becoming indigent, poor, and without much, I don't know. I'm bracing for the worst.
Yeah, the assumption on the part of a lot of the social scientists class and, you know, members of that particular tribe who had assumed that poverty bred crime were surprised to see rates of violent crime continue to decline over the course of the 2008-2009 recession and never recover. There was no direct correlation between financial hardship and precarity and incidents of violent crime. Maybe that changes, but it did not materialize after the last Great Recession.
I mean, there was no crime spree in the Great Depression either. I mean, there were of course spectacular, you know, tabloidy crime, you know, bank robbers and.
But there has been a bit of one now. I mean, I think we're like the city is double violent crimes where it was last year, right?
Right, but there are these kind of bizarre stats, you know, like that subway ridership is down 90%, and subway crime is up 30%. So of course that would suggest subway crime. You know, now some of that is because there are no eyes on the street in the subway platform, right? So people can do whatever they want to, and there are these horrible stories about what's gone on with the kind of indigent takeover of subway cars and people shooting people and having fist fights on subway cars and who knows what the hell else is going on. So there is that. I mean, but that is a species of the kind of vanilla sky on the beaching of New York City. You know, the sort of a world in which streets are empty or subways are empty late at night is a world in which people, bad people, can work their will. One of the reasons that New York became so incredibly safe, there was a kind of I don't know what you would call it—a kind of merging effect, which is that as the city got safe and people
felt much safer about being out and about at all times of the day and night. The city got safer because people were out and about all times of the night. And, you know, a street where there are people walking everywhere at all, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning is a street where a mugger is not going to feel comfortable mugging somebody, because that mugging requires a deserted moment, you know. So I don't know. Eli Lake, you wrote a brilliant and very important piece for us on the FBI scandal a couple months ago, relating to everything involving the investigation into Russian malfeasance in the 2016 campaign. One thing that we did not touch on in that piece, but that it appears to be accelerating, is the treatment of former National Security Advisor and in the Obama administration, head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, General Michael Flynn, right?
Right.
And Flynn, National Security Advisor, pled guilty to two counts, I think, of
lying to FBI investigators,
right. And has been in this peculiar limbo, I think, for almost 3 years, where he pled but hasn't been sentenced, and the sentencing is supposed to come, and then at some point they say, you know, he's cooperating, and then they say he's not cooperating. Anyway, the more one knows about the Flynn case, the scummier it seems, and that was also true at the time that he was... but can you go, and so there's things seem to be coming to a head, so we thought maybe you could give us some
sure
understanding of where things are.
Okay, so late last week, the long dormant Mike Flynn account on Twitter reemerged with, I think it was a Medium document of his sort of rescinded, official rescinding of his plea. I mean, he had done it before, but this was a sort of formal document that went through the arguments that he made, and he finally sort of put it on the record. A lot of us who covered this closely knew earlier that there was pressure that was put on him, that the FBI would pursue, the Justice Department would charge his son with violating the Foreign Agents Registration Act because of something that has nothing to do with Russia. It was a somewhat slimy contract that Flynn had with a businessman who was it was a cutout for the government of Erdogan. I think his main job or his main task was to produce a kind of documentary that attacked a Turkish cleric who is now living in the Poconos in Pennsylvania named Gulen, Fethullah Gulen, that was once an ally of the Islamist dictator of Turkey, Erdogan, but now is his biggest rival. And his followers were responsible for an aborted coup in 2016. And so, as one would imagine, the Turkish government is absolutely livid about this and would at some point like for the U.S. government to send Gulen, who is in his 70s now, back to Turkey, where he will be tried and likely executed. And that's probably never going to happen, precisely because he will be executed. And we have no faith in the Turkish justice system at this point. So there's reasons beyond. I think it would be very difficult to get any judge to agree to that. But that is what the Turkish government wanted. That's why they hired Flynn. And instead of filing this under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, he filed it under a looser set of guidelines known as the Lobbying Disclosure Act. Now, I should say, I'm somebody who really thinks there should be better enforcement of Foreign Agents Registration Act, and that more people who are getting money from foreign governments, whether that's Paul Manafort or Tony Podesta, you know, that they should disclose it. And I'd like to see more enforcement of that. That's been my position for many years. On the other hand, it was standard practice in Washington that if you could file something under the Lobbying Disclosure Act, you would do that as opposed to the Foreign Agents Registration Act. What's more, the Foreign Agent Registration Act, until the Trump presidency, was never enforced really at all. It was sort of you were fined at worst and you had to refile your paperwork. And that laxness, by the way, the FBI is in charge of that. That all happened when Mueller was the director of the FBI, and before him, Louis Freeh. So in some ways, Mueller is you could argue is responsible for the lax enforcement of FARA, but it's really, you know, the Justice Department under Republicans and Democrats have just not taken that law particularly seriously. So that's the sort of that's the context of the Flynn plea. Now, the other thing, of course, we know is that Flynn was alleged and was investigated at one point by the FBI for something far graver, which is, was he part of a conspiracy with Russia to influence the 2016 election? There were certainly some very troubling things that were in the public record. He had appeared at this gala for the Russian propaganda station RT in 2015, where he sat at Vladimir Putin's table. He'd given lots of interviews to RT, or given a few interviews to RT, where he'd said some pretty critical things that at times sort of sounded more like what you'd hear from the Russian foreign ministry. But if you read the entirety of Flynn's remarks, or if you read his book that he wrote with Michael Ledeen, you know, Mike Flynn's argument was, I would like a working relationship with Russia so they can cooperate with us, maybe on Iran and maybe on ISIS in Syria. And that, I have to say, a version of that was John Kerry's position in 2015 and 2016. That was certainly the concept behind the reset for the first term of the Obama administration.
Now, okay, so here's my question. Yeah. So if I understand this correctly, the reason that this is now flared up, and for the rescinding of the plea, is that there is more evidence, or Flynn's case, having pled, so he pled, like he chose to plead and he pled.
Well, it's important because he's now saying he pleaded because they would have charged his son, and he was trying to protect his son, and he was also bankrupt. He had, in order to fight the case, he had to sell his home, and there was it was a pretty rough time for him.
Right. So, but there was also this claim that the FBI false flag investigated him by interviewing him without letting him know that he was being interviewed. In other words, without formally informing him that the conversation that he was having was the conversation they were having with someone they believed to be a target of the investigation, and that ordinarily, when you are a target of a federal investigation, you are formally informed that you are such a thing in order to prevent you from falsely unknowingly incriminating yourself.
Well, it's actually worse than that, because first of all, the FBI had the transcript of his conversation with Kislyak, so there was not an effort to learn
with that. So
okay, let me back up.
Calls. Flynn on November 30th, 2016, if I remember right.
No, it was Christmas Eve. Sorry. I think. Yeah.
Christmas Eve.
There were a few of these contacts with the Russian ambassador.
Ambassador, right? Now, yes. And we were told, and I think it's true, right, that the purpose of the call was that the incoming Trump administration was attempting to talk the Russians into not retaliating after the Obama administration kicked out 35 Russian officials for interfering, or for whatever, for interfering in the 2016 election. And that basically they said, hold off, where new guys are coming in, don't let's go to war now. And this somehow got transmuted because they didn't tell the truth about what they were up to. This got transmuted into, there was a secret spy deal going on between Flynn and Kislyak, the Russian ambassador.
Right. And then it was a violation of the Logan Act, which is such a crazy reach and an abuse of power, that there was a Logan Act investigation, which is an antiquated, likely unconstitutional law that says, if you're a private citizen, you cannot make foreign policy on behalf of the U.S. government. And the incoming national security advisor during a presidential transition is constantly in contact with foreign governments because they're about to become the government of the U.S. I mean, it's just incredible that this was something that then Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates believed was worthy of an investigation. And I mean, lots of journalists who should have known better went along with this crazy explanation of things. And so that was the kind of context of the FBI interviewing Mike Flynn, I think on his second day on the job, where it was not we're investigating this possible Logan Act, or, you know, you should know that you're a subject in our investigation of what you said to Kislyak. They already knew what he had said. And then even still, the FBI agents who interviewed him, I think including Peter Strzok, although we'll find out this week at some point if these things are unsealed, said that they did not believe that he was deliberately lying to them when they asked him these questions, because it was he thought it was a briefing with FBI guys in his new job, and he didn't remember it. And Comey, I think, had testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee along these lines that the people who interviewed him did not think that he was deliberately lying to them. And he was still charged with that because Mueller believed that if he could flip him, like you would flip a sort of mid-level or a mob person, you know, maybe you could get the Don, no pun intended. And so the idea is that he was cooperating in this other thing, which we were all sure there must be something there with Russian collusion. There was nothing really there with Russian collusion. He didn't end up charging anybody. So it does raise this question of, well, what was the investigation of Flynn all about? And I think that the fairer kind of criticism of the hyper-focus of some on Flynn is where we're, you know, this is fairly common practice with much lower profile people who don't have as much money. They're constantly, you know, when they get caught up in the criminal justice system, there's a huge effort to try to get them to plead to a crime that they may or may not have committed in order to avoid more hassle down the road. And it's something civil libertarians have complained about for decades. But in some ways, you could say that, but I think it's obvious that there was also a political motivation when it came to Flynn. So we'll find out, I think, now. What this is kind of now about is, was there further exculpatory evidence, such as the interviewers didn't think he was lying and other things like that, that were not shared with his initial defense counsel, who he dropped. Now he has this Sidney Powell kind of working with him. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, I don't know that the judge will necessarily buy all of it, but I do think that there's a pretty strong case. I agree with Andrew McCarthy, who wrote, I think, this week, that you know, he shouldn't have really been investigated on this stuff in the first place.
Right. So it raises the interesting example, the interesting possibility that that also that President Trump will pardon him.
I mean, if he pardoned him, I think there will be the usual, you know, outrage right. from the usual suspects. But I think Trump should pardon him.
I mean, at the very least, if all of this, if this narrative that you have laid out, and, you know, was obviously murky and complicated and all that, but if this argument laid out that he, of course, you know, he resigned as National Security Advisor in a kind of some weird trumped up reason that he had lied to Mike Pence, and therefore he no longer had the confidence of Mike Pence, because Mike Pence had asked him some question and he hadn't answered. That was the way that the White House was clearly had right. decided that he was a political liability in the first 3 weeks of the administration, figured out they could oust him without admitting anything about Russian collusion or anything like that.
Just doesn't add up. I mean,
so basically, I'm not a big fan of Michael Flynn's, but he was clearly hard done by everybody in this case, and has gone through one of these Kafka-esque nightmare yes. situations that nobody should go through.
Right, and it's right, and I think that also if the shoe was on the other foot, and this had happened to someone like Lonnie Grenier, or, you know, if you can imagine it happening to a Democrat, I think you would have much more of a chorus saying enough is enough. What the hell was the FBI doing? I mean, especially since now we know there was no conspiracy to charge. So right. and Flynn, which is one of the reasons Flynn says he was happy to cooperate, because he didn't think there was anything there. So again, what was the purpose of all of this? I mean, why and it does show a selective enforcement of certain laws. If you want to enforce FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, great. But the fact that Tony Podesta has not had any of these kinds of troubles that Flynn or some of these others have had, and Tony Podesta, I should say, he shared in some ways the contract with Paul Manafort for something called the Center for a Modern European Ukraine, which is a think tank, which was basically a mask for the government of the ousted Ukrainian president, Yanukovych. So, you know, everyone's like, oh, well, Manafort was lobbying for this guy who turned out to be basically a Russian puppet in Ukraine. Isn't that really bad? I'm like, yeah, it is really bad. So was, you know, John Podesta's brother, who's had one, at one point, now it's no longer, one of the most powerful lobbying shops in all of Washington. There was just, I mean, I'm sorry, but this stuff is bipartisan. It was really out of control. And you can't just tell me that, you know, you're interested in the Foreign Agents Registration Act or the ludicrous interpretation of the Logan Act. That to me is the real abuse, which is we now have a situation where the Justice Department can find any number of, you know, crimes you may have committed, ruin your life, and get you to plead to something. I don't want to live in a country like that.
Yeah. So Eli Lake, thank you so much for
hang on. Wait. All right. We have an update. There's an update to the Bill de Blasio story. That is worth mentioning for our audience. He has issued a qualified apology. Quote, if you saw anger and frustration, you're right, he said of his tweet. I spoke out of real distress. People's lives were in danger right before my eyes. He proceeded to say that he apologizes for people who thought that he was singling out the Jewish community. I can't imagine why anybody would think that. And then he proceeded to say that there are many people in this town who love to create confusion and division, sort of demonstrating all the density of a neutron star and demonstrating also why he really meant to say what he meant to say. You know, we haven't talked about it briefly. The whole strategy, the political strategy on the part of this mayoralty has been division. Racial and ethnic division along the lines of the virus. That's why they put out these lists of racial demographics that are more affected or less affected by this disease, demonstrating that African Americans and Hispanics get it worse and are suffering worse from it. And it seems to be that his desire here is to pit demographic groups against demographic groups, and he kind of got called out on it in this case, which is heartening in a way, but he doesn't demonstrate very much contrition for it. He's just annoyed that everybody saw what he was doing finally for the first time.
It's the classic, I'm sorry if you are offended, apology, non-apology.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand how that's an apology at all. I was righteously angry. So if you, I was right, actually. If you really think about it, I was right. And, you know, maybe I was emotional, but I was right to be emotional. And I mean, I guess his hashish dealer didn't show up this morning.
I love it.
Anyway, so you know what? It's not fair to say hashish dealer. I don't think he smokes hashish. I think he smokes marijuana, which, you know.
He probably vapes at this point. It's much healthier.
Okay, there you go. Well, you vape marijuana. Anyway,
right.
Eli Lake, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be
us.
Here. And thank you guys for doing it. It really is a lifeline of sanity for me.
And for you. And it's a lifeline of sanity for us because, as I say, like, I don't know what Noah and Abe would look like if they didn't have this hour a day to, you know, to you know, I mean, I don't know why. You would have shaved your, like, you would have a mohawk, Abe, along with your, yeah.
That's next.
Go all Travis Bickle on us. So for Abe, Christine, and Noah, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.